Well, the meaning of faith. Most sermons have a structure. The structure is you put out the idea, you examine it, you create some metaphors for people to take away that are examples that are make the point easier to understand, and then there's an exhortation at the end that you can carry with you out the door. Today's going to be a little different because Barbara called me or emailed me with what she was going to talk about. And so this morning's message is going to begin with philology, go on to theology, do a little bit of comparative religion, and then have a sermonic conclusion. This I hope to accomplish before the Super Bowl starts at 3:15 next Sunday. The meaning of faith. Well, if you take it as a literal question, it's unconstitutionally vague because the root words of faith are completely different from our everyday language use of the word faith. When we talk about faith, I want you to take it on faith that I'm going to do the right thing. I want you to take the promises of this politician on faith. I want you to believe as I want you to believe. That's taking something on faith. It is acting as if you believed something, and that's not the original meaning of the word in either its Latin root or its Greek root. The Latin root is fides, meaning fidelity, meaning faithfulness to something. It isn't about belief, it's about commitment. It's about a sense of constancy, but not constancy that's never questioned. Faith and faithfulness are not things that are not tested within us, not questioned. They should be questioned when we are faithful to a cause, to a party, to a policy. Are we faithful out of stubbornness? Are we faithful because it's easier not to examine it? Or are we faithful to something that is of a value and the strategy, the tactic, the goal might change, but we are in touch with something inside us, a value to which we are faithful, though our actions can from time to time change. And faithfulness is also not constant in terms of mood. Any of us who is or has ever been married understands that love is not constant. It, as I mentioned 9 years ago, it ebbs and flows in the tides of life, love, and relationship. Faithfulness, divine faithfulness, all you have to do is look at the Psalms of David, who says, God, it's really wonderful, hallelujah! And not in the Leonard Cohen sense of hallelujah, but hallelujah, what a great, beautiful day. And other times, it's, oh, what are you doing to me? Where have you gone? Why am I suffering? Faithfulness is not constancy of mood, but it is faithfulness to the connection, to the relationship in good times and in bad times. But the emotions can change. In the Greek, the word is pistos. It means, it's the root word of knowledge, epistemology. It is not something that we believe, it's something that we know. It's something that we know to be true internally. It isn't taking it on, to take something on faith in the everyday, ordinary English language way and the pistos way of its absolute, what philosophers call, apodictic certainty. It doesn't need to be demonstrated because you know it. Those are the classic roots of the word faith, which have come to mean just opinion or belief or blind faith. But what all of them have together, because they're not completely dissimilar, they're tied together with an idea of trust. Even the blind faith is about trust. Even the fidelity is, of course, about trust. And the pistos, the question of knowledge, is about trusting those things that we know about ourselves and our values. Which brings me to the opening words. I can't hear them or read them or study them without cringing, without asking questions, without going into an examination of why in the world these stories are central to great religious traditions, central to Judaism, central to Christianity, as we'll see, and central to Islam, although in the Quran it is Ishmael who is taken to the mountain, but the issue of sacrifice is the same. Now, look, on the face of this story, most of us want to run screaming. So God says to Abraham, in that voice that God has, "Abraham, I want you to take your son and take him up to Mount Moriah and sacrifice him." This then becomes the next sentence in English is every bar mitzvah student's favorite line in the Bible. "And so Abraham saddled his ass." Bar mitzvah students are 12 years old, so you ought to know, and already I have one walkout. But it's a perfectly good, obviously biblical word, or God wouldn't have used it. Anyway, but look at the context. The context is Abraham, in an earlier story, God had said, Abram, "I'm going to destroy the wicked cities of Sodom and Gomorrah," which, you know, as wicked cities go, were, you know, not Vegas, but they were bad. And Abraham said, no, don't do that. Why are you going to do that? And he bargained with God. He said, "Look, if there are 90 righteous people, wouldn't you let them live? If there were 75, 95, wouldn't you let them live?" He bargains with God about Sodom and Gomorrah, but God says to Abraham, "I want you to cut the throat and burn your son." And he goes, "Cool, okay, let's go." I mean, why is he bargaining here and just accepting it there? Well, it will not surprise you that there's a lot of scholarly discussion and absolutely no scholarly agreement on what the passage means. Some will say, look, it's just a story. Get over it. It's about you don't have to, the sacrifice is not going to happen. It's a message, which is we shouldn't sacrifice our children anymore. God is not Moloch and does not demand human sacrifice, so knock it off. That's legitimate. There's another view that says, look, Abraham was in on the fix. That God said to Abraham, when God announced to Abraham, "Abe, look, you're 98 years old, and Sarai is past the age of women, but you two are going to have a baby." And he laughed. And the name Isaac comes from the Hebrew Yitzhak, which means he laughed. Then God said the part that wasn't so funny, and he said, "Well, Abe, I want you to take a sharp stone and go outside of the camp and circumcise yourself, and then you'll be able to impregnate your wife." Boy, talk about a bad HMO. And that your son, Isaac, will be a founder of nations, and his descendants will be like the stars in the heavens. So if Abraham is believing God's first promise and God says, go sacrifice him, then one of the interpretations is it's a ritual and he knows it's a ritual. Third interpretation is that it's exemplary. When God, when the Torah says that God tested Abraham, I always love the term God tested. God tests Job, God tests Abraham. Job says, "Couldn't I take a written? Do I really have to lose everything? I mean, couldn't we come up with another way?" And Rambam, Maimonides, says, well, no. It's not a test in that sense, because God, being infinite in time, infinite in space, infinite in wisdom, knows Abraham's character and Job's character. And tests are not tests because God's in on it. God knows how it's going to come out. So it's exemplary. It's there to show people how they should understand faith and faithfulness and the issue of trust. Now, what's missing from the story is also interesting to me. It actually doesn't name Isaac in going back home with Abraham. He returns with the lads, but Isaac shows up later. And the Bible and most of the commentary misses the question, which I think would explain a lot about what goes on in every society, not to mention the Middle East, of post-traumatic stress disorder. When your father says, come on, and takes you to a mountain and ties you and tries to cut your throat, this is something that Freud might have analyzed as a traumatic experience, as something that might have affected your ability to trust authority and family and the bonds of love. But no, there are commentaries that say, look, Isaac was not a child. He went along with it, and he knew. And when his father said, God will provide, he trusted his father. So the story is very complex about what faith is and what faithfulness is. And in fact, my favorite take on it is Woody Allen's, not surprisingly, where Woody Allen has Sarah say to Abraham, where are you going? He said, well, I'm saddling my ass and I'm taking Isaac up to the mountain and I'm going to sacrifice him. And she said, you're going to what? Well, God said so. And you would just listen to any crazy voice in the desert? You didn't ask anything. You didn't ask if perhaps it was a joke some kind of it wasn't your friend Maury who was... Now, only God has that deep and mellifluous voice in the desert, and you know, considering how business is right now, it would be a bad idea to disobey. You would think that there would be some conversation in order to make this reading, which happens every year at the second day of Rosh Hashanah, so central. And it becomes so central not simply in Judaism, with the complexity of the story, but now take a look at the elements of the story. Saddling, we'll change it now for the Gospels. Saddling a donkey, riding to the place of sacrifice, hello Palm Sunday, carrying the wood for the sacrifice up a hill, and being bound to the wood for the sacrifice. In the sequel, the Gospels, it's the same story, the same elements. And what binds them together, in my view, are a couple of things. One, Abraham and Isaac and Ishmael and Jesus are not simple victims who have been overpowered by either heavenly fathers or earthly fathers. They have a choice of obeying, and in fact, aside from Abraham, they question. Isaac questions. So, Pop, we're going up to the mountain, and I see the donkey, and I see the wood, and I don't see the ram. And God will provide. But he asks the question. Jesus, as he begins to show that each must take his cross and how he would go to Jerusalem to be crucified, he's given a choice. He's not a victim of God. He says, you know, let this cup pass, but if it's not to pass, I'll accept it. There is an act of will where human beings are not puppets and are not victims, but they have a choice of faithfulness to something in these stories. And please be clear, I am taking these stories seriously, but not at all historically or literally. I'm looking at why they have been central to how Western people, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, in chronological order, have found these to be important issues. We do sacrifice our children still to war. We do obey, And we do question, which is what all of these stories are about. It's about trust, but it's not about blind trust. It is about a sense of obedience, but it's obedience that is chosen, not obedience that is compelled. And ultimately about some sense of moral responsibility. Now, take away the literalness for a moment. Take away the blood. Take away the sacrificial issues, because the sacrificial issues can't be theological. It cannot be God needed the blood and God needed the pain. Talk about what and how it speaks to us about issues of faith and values, and how it can speak to us if we get rid of some of the blood and think about it in terms of faithfulness to values and to life. Unitarian Julia Ward Howe, in writing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, has that final verse: "In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea, in a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. His truth goes marching on." This, in good Unitarian fashion, was changed to "As he died to make men holy, let us live to make men free." And now we can all, it's also been changed and degenderized and all the other stuff, but the message, it seems to me, is relatively clear in both versions. We talk about sacrificing in terms, and we read those stories in terms of sacrificing somebody's life, giving somebody's life for something, as opposed to seeing it just with a different preposition, giving our lives to something. It is not a question simply in reading these stories about what demands the sacrifice of our lives in the form of death. Well, what demands the sacrifice, the dedication of our life to our best values? What things do we treasure enough, hold sacred enough, and central enough to who we are as human beings, not to give our lives for, but to give our lives to justice, to mercy, to equality, to a vision of a better world, to peace? These are all values that we can incarnate in the dedication, which often involves sacrifice, of our time and our treasure and our talent, that involves sacrifice of giving things up in order that other priorities are achieved. The issue for me is faith and faithfulness to something that is intrinsic at the core of each of us and our examined values. And just because Eva's here, I'm going to end with a quote from T.S. Eliot, because whenever she's here, I have to end with a quote from T.S. Eliot because she expects it of me. No, you just tease me about quoting Eliot a lot. And in one of the four quartets, Little Gidding, he talks about sacrifice demanding nothing less than everything. When we go inside and ask ourselves what in our lives demands nothing less than everything, our individual answers will differ and should differ. But the process of asking, what is holy? What is intrinsic? What do I believe so deeply about the mission and the purpose of my life that I am willing to dedicate not death, but life to that cause? Dedicate it not in a way that is stubborn with closed ears and closed eyes and closed mind, that is open to mid-course correction, that is open to the voices of others, that is open to reason. But still, what is the holy ground that I know to be central to myself? So in this unusual sermonic structure, you get examination, you get examples, and then you get questions. Because at these prices, you don't get answers to that eternal question.